Somebody help me push.
It took seven of us, but we were able to roll the boulder a few feet to one side. Behind it was a tunnel that led away into the dark.
I'll be damned, Parkins said. Is that a back way into the mine?
And out of the loop, said Leo.
A hollow wouldn't have had any trouble moving that boulder, I pointed out.
Well, I think that about clears things up, don't you?
Parkins said testily.
Now, Lamoth, your people better return my girl and double quick.
Lamoth laughed.
Oh, this doesn't end here. This ain't over until we get Ellery.
Parkins was practically vibrating with frustration.
Now listen here, Lamoth. You don't see Burnham holding up the talks because the whites took a feral from him.
This is different.
This was an act of war perpetrated upon me while we were supposed to be talking peace.
Mr. Lamoth, be reasonable,
Miss Wren pleaded. He rounded on her.
Okay, try this on. You say these were the same whites who broke out of your jail. So either you can't keep your own house in order, or I'm left to assume you let them out on purpose.
That's absurd,
Miss Wren cried.
He makes a damn good point, said Leo. You birds were supposed to have put the kibosh on these whites and their monsters months ago, and now they're out raising hell again? How can we trust anyone so incompetent?
Lamoth turned his hissing raccoons on me.
So you're some famous hotshot tracker, he said. Well, you better be.
Lamoth stepped toward me and shoved a small card into my hands. It was a photograph of a girl wearing an eye patch and a giant black dress that swallowed her bottom half.
No,
Miss Peregrine snatched the photo away from me.
Jacob's not involved in this.
You're the one dragged him into it,
Lamoth said, his eyes burning like coals.
Clean up your mess, Peregrine. Get my girl back, or you can forget about any peace accord.
Chapter 7.
I'm so sorry, Jacob. I so regret putting you in this situation.
Miss Peregrine, Emma, and Enoch were following me through tunnels as I tracked the trail of hologast residue. It was easy enough to follow down here, but what about on the other side of the loop?
What if I can't do it? I said. I've never tracked a hollow like this before. I'm not like Addison, who can smell peculiars from a long way off.
What you can do is even better.
You can sense them.
The trail led to the loop entrance the Americans used, yet another elevator, which led us up through a much gentler changeover and into the present. We walked out into a lobby full of tourists.
Hope you folks had a great time.
A grinning tour guide slapped a sticker on my shirt that read, I saw the old time gold mine, and all I got was this lousy sticker. Soaked into the carpet by the exit, I saw a black spot. The hollow had come through this way, into the present. The trail of hologast residue continued outside, down the sidewalk, around a corner, and I found it easier and easier to follow, so that after a while I hardly even had to look for it. My nose, and more than that, a sensation in my gut, was telling me where to go. I felt like an old cartoon character following the wafting scent of a pie cooling in a window. We were passing through the crowded center of the downtown, and I worried that my companion's old clothes might attract attention until I looked more closely around me. There were people in Old West costumes, in full cowboy attire, and dressed like old-timey madams, walking everywhere. A lot of the old buildings had been preserved. What had once been a lawless frontier town had become a kind of open-air Wild West theme park, and you could get your photo taken in Old West gear, buy chaps and 10-gallon hats and replica buffalo bones at gift shops, and watch costumed reenactments of famous shootouts. One was happening in the town square right now, The duelists cheered on by a crowd of sun-baked tourists and their bratty, distracted kids. I couldn't help but be reminded of the very real armed standoff that was still happening inside the loop, and I realized that this town was the perfect cover for a loop entrance. The comings and goings of strange people in strange costumes would arouse no special interest at all.
"This is fun for normals," Enoch said. "Watching people pretend to shoot one another."
"Keep your eyes sharp," Emma hissed, scanning the faces of the crowd.
"Murnau and the other whites could still be nearby. It would be best if we saw them before they saw us."
That brought me solidly back to reality. Right now, we were hunting the whites, but if they ever realized it, they'd start hunting us right back. The idea jogged loose a question that had been burning in my mind earlier, but which I hadn't been able to ask in front of the Americans.
"Miss P, how did you find the place where the hollow residue started?"
Emma's head snapped toward me.
"What's that?"
"There wasn't any residue in the tent," I said. "I made that up. The real trail started 1,000 feet away, and somehow Miss P led me right to it." I looked at her expectantly. She returned a sphinx-like smile.
"As we inspected the scene, I realized the whites themselves never entered the Marrowbone Loop. They sent their hologast instead, along with someone else. Someone who wouldn't attract much attention.
That was the person who snuck into the girl's tent and kidnapped her, dragging her to the spot where the hologast had apparently been waiting, where you discovered its residue trail."
"But how did you track that person?"
"Imbrinley intuition," she said.
Enoch groaned.
"Oh, come on."
"All right, then. I noticed light but unusual boot prints leading in and out of the torn tent back, a tread pattern made by a high-traction sole, not the smooth-soled cowboy boots favored by the Californios or the moccasins most northerners wear. It led out along the tree line."
"You never cease to amaze, miss," Emma said. "So who's this other person?" asked Enoch.
"Based on the shoe size and, well, Imbrinley intuition, I suspect it's a girl of about the same physical age and build as Ellery. Just follow the hologast scent and sense trail. These whites don't travel anywhere without hollows, and I doubt they'll suspect they're being tracked that way. You have the advantage, for now, at least."
"It's only an advantage if they always travel on foot," I said. "If they got into a car..." I'd been expecting the trail to dry up at any moment, to dead end at a parking lot and an empty parking space.
"Stuffed into a car with a hologast," Enoch said. "What a disgusting scenario."
"Disgusting or not, there's no way I could track that. There wouldn't be any residue droplets to follow, and the scent trail would be way too faint." I sighed.
"My tracking ability just isn't that developed."
Miss Peregrine raised an eyebrow at me.
"I think you might surprise yourself, Mr. Portman. Look where you've led us."
I looked up. The trail was headed straight for a bus station.
"Are you kidding?" Emma said. "They took a hologast on a bus?"
"No way," I said. We went inside. The waiting area was depressing and gray, and probably hadn't been cleaned since the 1970s. Bums occupied the corners. Everyone else looked haggard and pissed off as they waited. I followed a light trail of hollow residue to the bus boarding area, where it suddenly disappeared.
Unbelievable. They had caught a bus.
I ran back to find my friends, and there was Emma, running toward me, eyes wide.
"Somebody recognized one of them," she said, waving the whites' mugshots at me, then grabbing my arm to pull me over to the ticket window.
"Yeah, I saw them," said the man behind the counter, bored. "Couple hours ago. They left on the 5 o'clock to Cleveland."
He returned his attention to a basketball game he was watching on his phone. Miss Peregrine rapped on the window.
"How many stops does that bus make between here and Cleveland?"
He sighed, fished a paper out of a drawer and slapped it on the counter. Here's the schedule. She looked at it.
5 stops, she said,
in a journey of about 1,000 miles. She rapped on the window again.
When does the next bus to Cleveland leave?
45 minutes, he said without looking up. She turned to me with a self-satisfied smile.
See, Mr. Portman, just when you were about to lose hope.
We'll stop at all the same stops they did, Emma said, and you can check for hollow goo. She was rubbing her hands together, getting excited just like she did whenever a plan came together or an impossible problem began to seem solvable. It was one of the things I loved about her, and always would.
Enoch groaned again.
And here I was hoping we might spend tonight in our own beds.
You still can, I said. No one's making you come.
He's coming, Emma said. He just can't pass up a chance to complain.
We found a deserted section of the waiting area and sat on a bench, a broken coin-operated TV bolted to the arm. My head felt like it weighed 1,000,000 pounds. It was so full. I was vibrating with stress, but I also could have fallen asleep on the metal bench if I just lay down. Everything in our world was unsettled and breaking apart, and yet Emma and Enoch were joking about something they'd seen the normals in town wearing, and Miss Peregrine's expression was completely placid as she looked around, thinking whatever she was thinking. Maybe they were so used to living under the looming threat of multiple catastrophes that it didn't affect them much anymore, but I couldn't take it.
Why are you guys so sure I can do this? I said, struggling to hide my frustration.
Because you're Jacob, Emma shrugged.
I never said you could do it, Enoch said, but it sounded more interesting than bookmarking atlases with Millard all day.
I turned to Miss Peregrine, our rock of sanity and wisdom.
What happens if I lose the trail and can't find them? What happens if we can't get the girl back?
Tell me it won't be so bad. Tell me the world won't end if I fail at this.
What will happen?
She sighed.
The Americans could lose faith in us, pull out of the conference, and go back to fighting one another. Or they may go to war right away, no matter what we do.
She said it so casually, my jaw almost dropped.
Miss P, pardon me for saying so, but you don't sound like you care all that much, said Emma.
I care a great deal, she replied, and the other Imbruns and I will do our level best to keep the negotiations afloat, no matter what happens. But there's only so much we can control. The Americans have to want peace. We can't force that. And even if we forge an airtight peace accord, it's always possible that it could fall apart one day.
Then why send us to do this, said Enoch. If it might not matter anyway, why bother rescuing this girl?
Her placid expression vanished, and her eyes narrowed.
Because it's not the girl I care about, she said. It's the whites.
Now Emma looked shocked. Miss Peregrine didn't usually speak so bluntly, but it seemed she had decided to treat us like adults.
This kidnapping wasn't a random act. I don't buy Miss Wren's theory. I think this abduction was about more than causing chaos and sabotaging the peace.
Then what was it about? I said.
Follow the whites, she said. Observe them, and we may yet find out.
And the girl? Enoch said.
Get her back if you can, but don't take unnecessary risks. I could abide any number of personal failures, but I could not abide losing any of you.
And what will you be doing while we're on this dangerous mission? Enoch asked.
I'll be watching.
Emma looked surprised.
You're not coming with us?
Not exactly, Miss Peregrine replied. But I'll never be far away.
Oh, and I want you to bring Hugh along.
Enoch cocked his head.
That's a bit random.
Can he be here in half an hour? I said, glancing at a wall clock.
should be here any minute, said Miss Peregrine. I sent for him some time ago.
And just then Hugh walked into the building, escorted by Ulysses Critchley, and waved to us, grinning, from across the ticket hall.
Why, Hugh,
Enoch said under his breath.
If you thought we needed backup, why not, I don't know, Bronwyn?
Because he is capable and selfless, said Miss Peregrine. And frankly, he needs a bit of adventure to take his mind off Fiona.
I couldn't argue with that. The poor guy spent every unoccupied moment worrying himself to death. The bus company's name and logo had been borrowed from a character in children's literature. He could fly, befriended fairies, and lived on an island where no one aged, and the cartoon image of him that was emblazoned on the bus, smiling in a jaunty feathered cap, clashed hilariously with the desperately gritty station. Before I could follow my friends aboard, Miss Peregrine pulled me aside to speak to me alone.
You've had dreams about him, haven't you? My brother.
I forgot, for a moment, to breathe.
Yes.
But they seemed like more than just dreams, she said. Like he was inside your head. I was nodding like a robot.
Yes, yes.
I've had them too.
Really?
He may be trying to reach out to us via our dreams, to torment us. The two people he hates the most in the world, who he blames for his downfall. But believe me, Jacob, taunting us with visions is all he can do.
Are you sure?
I said. What if they're trying to bring him back? She shook her head firmly.
It's impossible. He's stuck down a very deep hole, and he's stuck there forever. That I promise you.
But that won't necessarily stop them from trying, I said. Do you think that's what they're doing? Trying to bring back Call?
Please keep your voice down, she said, glancing around. And don't let your imagination run away with you.
Remember, Bob the Revelator also predicted many things that never came to pass. So let us just focus on the task before us, and don't make too much of this. And please, don't tell the others. I nodded.
Okay.
But the next time he appears to you in a dream,
tell me.
The bus started its engine. My friends were waving to me from the windows. And then I ran onto the bus.
I brought some gifties, said Hugh,
digging into a small bag in his lap. We'd only been riding the bus for a few minutes, and Enoch was already asleep, but now he roused himself. Emma and I leaned over our seats to look across the aisle.
When everyone found out I was coming, they gave me things to bring to you. Claire packed us stew meat sandwiches.
He pulled out several, wrapped in brown paper, and distributed them.
Spare underwear and socks, courtesy of Bronwyn. Oh, this is good. Two peculiar sheep's wool sweaters from Horace.
Yes, said Enoch. I was wondering what became of those.
They got a bit moth-eaten, but Horace has been repairing them in his spare time.
They can stop bullets, but not moths, Emma said.
Devil's Acre moths can eat through metal, Hugh explained.
And flesh, I hear, said Enoch. Wonderful species.
Hugh held up a dog-eared book.
Olive's copy of Peculiar Planet, North America.
He shook it, and a map fell out from between the pages.
And Millard tucked in a recent map of American loops. And this one's for you, he said, and handed me a small box.
Who from? I asked. He winked.
Guess.
There was a note on the top of it, written in a neat, looping hand. It read, "The sunset you missed." I opened it. A stream of amber light floated up and out of it, glistening and sparkling like dust motes caught in a sunbeam. They circled around me so that it was all I could see for a moment, before fading away. I was left with a pleasant tingling in my face.
Wow, said Hugh. That was beautiful.
It actually was, said Enoch.
Someone might have seen that, Emma said grumpily, but the other dozen or so passengers on the bus were staring at their phones or looking out the windows, and no one had.
Don't be jealous, Enoch teased her. It doesn't suit you.
What? I'm not, she stuttered, frowning.
Oh, shut up.
She got up and went to sit in a different seat.
Don't mind her, Enoch said. She takes a long time to get over things. She moaned about Abe for half a century.
Let me see that loop map, I said, anxious to change the subject. I squeezed into Enoch and Hugh's seat, and we opened it across our laps, and pretty soon we were absorbed in the strangeness of it. I'd seen loop maps written in gold calligraphy and leather-bound atlases that weighed a ton. I'd seen them scrawled on restaurant placemats, traced over other maps, routes drawn with pushpins and yarn. But I had never seen anything like this one. It was a real map and a modern one, like something you'd buy at a gas station on a road trip. Strangest of all, there were ads running down the sides. Ads for loops. They sounded like truck stops, gas, food, lodging, with a few peculiar perks. Hot meals at all hours, read one. Hotel-style accommodations. Another boasted, disaster-free loop day. Perfect weather, peaceful normals, experience our hospitality. And another, armed peacekeepers ensure a relaxing stay. One even had a coupon, clip for a 10% discount.
What kind of bizarre country is this? Asked Hugh.
One without Imbruns, said Enoch.
Peculiardom was many things, but it had never struck me as particularly capitalistic. American peculiardom was a different animal from what I'd come to know in Europe. That had already been made obvious to me in 100 ways since I'd first met H a few weeks earlier, but the realization kept hitting me.
A hotel-style loop, Enoch said sleepily. Sounds like heaven.
Don't get your hopes up, I said. I don't think these whites are interested in creature comforts.
Well, they'll have to stop somewhere, Enoch said. The kidnapped girl is loop-trapped. She'll age forward if they don't.
You're assuming they need to keep her alive, Hugh said.
They went to a lot of trouble to snatch her, said Enoch. I'm sure their intention wasn't just to let her wither into a pile of dusty bones.
We rolled on. The sun began to sink. Enoch and Hugh joked around, messing with the other passengers using one of Hugh's bees. I could tell Enoch was doing his best to keep Hugh's spirits up, and it made me like Enoch a little more. He was sweet-natured, despite his best efforts to be a jerk all the time. I went back to my seat and fell asleep with one of Horace's sweaters balled between my head and the window. It was an uneasy sleep full of uneasy dreams I couldn't remember. I woke with a start. Someone had sat down next to me. It was Emma. Her hands were knotted in her lap, and she looked tense. She checked over her shoulder to make sure Enoch and Hugh weren't listening to us. When she saw they were sleeping, she spoke.
We need to talk about it, she said. What happened between us?
That woke me up quick.
Oh, I said, rubbing my face. Okay, but I thought we had sort of agreed not to talk about it.
I've been trying not to think about it, she said. Tried ignoring it, pretending it isn't there, pretending that we were only ever just friends. But it's not working.
That's pretty obvious, I said. Every time someone mentions Noor, you go dark.
I just need to say I'm sorry one more time. I'm sorry for what I did. I shouldn't have called him.
A surge of complicated emotions rose in my chest. It sounded so small when she said it. I had ended things with her because of a phone call. Part of me still wondered if I had overreacted, if I had broken her heart over something petty.
Had you been doing that a lot? I asked her,
calling Abe? No, only that one time, from the road, and that was just to say goodbye. I didn't know if I believed her, or if I cared. Suddenly, the way I'd felt that day flooded back, the sad certainty that she'd never really been mine, and never would be, that I had fooled myself because I loved the idea that someone like Emma could love me. In a way, I'm glad you did it, I said. It made me face something I hadn't wanted to look at head on. What's that? She asked timidly. You said it yourself a few days ago. I'm not Abe, and I'm never going to be.
Oh, Jacob, I'm sorry I said that. I was angry.
I know, and that's why you let yourself be so honest. Because the truth is, you still love him.
She was quiet, and that was her answer. It was simple. She had been unable to stop herself from falling for me because I reminded her so much of him, and I hadn't broken her heart because she had never really given it to me in the first place.
I don't want you to hate me, she said.
She lowered her head. She looked so young in that moment, in that light. I felt sorry for her. I could never hate you. Her head fell against my shoulder, and I let it stay there.
It was nearly dark now. I watched the last sliver of crimson sun slip behind some mountains beyond the road, the land around us fading to a sad late evening blue.
So what did he say? I said. What did you talk about when you called him?
He didn't say anything, really.
She sighed.
He was angry. He said I shouldn't have called.
You couldn't help yourself,
she said so quietly I could hardly hear.
He said I was interrupting dinner, and he hung up.
When she looked up, there were tears in her eyes.
I felt like such an idiot.
And then I had to come back to the car where you were waiting and pretend nothing had happened.
A little stab of pain shot through me, and then a thought I hadn't anticipated flitted through my head. Was my grandpa kind of a jerk? I put my arm around her and said, I'm sorry, Em.
Don't be, she said. I needed to hear it, to let him go, finally.
Finally, but too late for us.
I know we can't be close like that anymore, she said. But we had a friendship too, and it was real and worth something.
It still is, I said. And something unlocked in her, and her shoulders began to tremble. I'd meant what I said. I still believed that all the wonderful things I had felt about her were true. It just didn't make me in love with her anymore, not the way they once had.
Thank you, she said, still sniffling. So, how do we do this?
Like this, I said, closing my arm into a hug. And now we should both get some sleep. A tap on my arm. Emma whispering, we've stopped. I blinked. It was the middle of the night and we'd arrived at some bus station in Iowa.
You go first,
Enoch said, nudging me down the aisle toward the door. I got out, surveying the ground around the bus parking area for hollow residue. Nothing. They hadn't stopped here. We went into the station, which had a small all-night food court. Enoch and Hugh got some rubbery hot dogs. Emma had a bean and cheese burrito. They were all aging day by day now. Teenagers in growing teenage bodies for the first time in almost a century, and they were always hungry. But my stomach was in knots, and the thought of eating made me nauseous. It was odd, I thought, how sometimes my friend seemed ancient, but at other times I felt older than them. We got back on the bus and rode on. I was drifting in and out of an anxious sleep when, sometime before dawn, Emma shook me awake. We were stopped on the highway. The bus snarled in a long traffic jam. Somewhere up ahead, we could see the lights of emergency vehicles flashing. I started to get a bad feeling. Three lanes of traffic were bottlenecked into one. Slowly, the scene came into view. There had been a bad accident. There were police cars, ambulances, a fire truck, flares, cops directing traffic, a circus of grim activity. My eyes couldn't help following a swirl of bold black tire marks past a torchlight parade of flares to the back of a wrecked bus.
"Oh my God,"
Emma whispered, her face washed over by red and orange flashes.
"Could that be the same bus?" Hugh said. "The one they were on?"
"We'd better find out," I said. Enoch said nothing, but he was nodding. Traffic had come to a standstill. I led my friends off the bus, pushing through the door over the driver's grunted objections. "There's no way the police are going to let us snoop around an accident scene," I said.
"You'd be surprised where you can go if you act like you belong there," said Emma.
There were a few paramedics still circling the wreck, but it seemed the accident was a few hours old already, and the injured had long since been taken away. The bus lay on its side like a fallen giant, its bent and gashed frame flickering in the riot of lights. It looked like it had skidded off the road, tipped sideways, and dug a hole in the earth on its way to the edge of some woods. There were no other smashed vehicles that we could see. The bus appeared to have lost control and crashed on its own. It didn't take me long to find the hollow's residue trail. It was splattered all around the bus, and it led from the wreckage into the woods. There were no police, no EMTs in the woods, nothing at all but dark trees. I followed the trail, and my friends followed me. When we'd gotten 20 or 30 feet past the tree line, Emma sparked a flame in her hand to light our way. We passed a pile of trash, a cluster of spiny brush, and then we found her, lying in a pile of leaves. The girl, Ellery. She was dying, bleeding from a gash on her head, her leg twisted unnaturally beneath her. We rushed to her.
"Someone get help!"
Emma shouted, and Hugh took off running back toward the EMTs. She was a slight, pale girl. She had only one eye, and the eye patch that normally covered the other one was gone. In its place was a black and puckered hole. While we waited for help to arrive, we tried to find out what had happened. But Ellery was disoriented, fading in and out of consciousness.
"They wanted me to cry," she was saying. "The men with the blank eyes, they made me cry."
As she said it, a tiny white worm crawled out of her eye socket. It tumbled down her face and onto the ground, where I noticed 100 more just like it, wriggling among the fallen leaves. I nearly vomited. Emma and Enoch seemed unfazed.
"They stole her,"
she said, starting to cry.
"They took her from me."
"Who?" said Emma.
"Matter Worm,"
she whispered, voice shaking.
"She'll die now. She can't live outside."
Emma, Enoch, and I looked up, exchanged a look of dread. "Where are the men now?" I said.
"Gone,"
she said.
"Will you kill them?"
"Oh, definitely,"
Enoch said.
"But not the girl. She doesn't want to do the things she does. They make her."
"What girl?" I said.
"She did it. She stopped the bus."
"How?"
"With her ropes. And she gave me the most beautiful flowers."
She began to convulse just as the EMTs arrived. Their flashlights lit everything up, and a moment later we were pulled away so they could work on her. Ellery was writhing, groaning, and something else was happening,
though she was blocked by the EMTs and I couldn't see what it was. I heard one of them swear as the group of them backed away from her. Someone said, "What the hell is going on?" And then suddenly I could see her again. Ellery was in the grip of a violent convulsion, and there seemed to be a nest of silky threads growing around her.
"Jesus," Enoch said. "She's starting to age forward."
It was hair, sprouting from her scalp at an exponential rate, blanching from brown to silver to ivory as it did. And then a sudden wind bent the branches and blew the leaves around us, and we looked back to see a helicopter landing just beyond the woods. We crouched, watching, unsure what to do. Several figures jumped out of the helicopter and ran toward us. It was the Americans. Lamothe and his bodyguard running through the woods shouting Ellery's name. Miss Peregrine, Miss Wren, and Miss Cuckoo were right behind them and couldn't spare even a glance in our direction. The EMTs were shoved away, horrified. They had been about to run anyway. And as the Americans bent over Ellery, I saw the Imbruns pouring something from a glass vial into her slack mouth. It was clear they were trying to save her somehow, but the girl was aging fast nonetheless. They picked her up, and I got a look as she was carried past. In the space of 30 seconds, her skin had thinned to near translucence, and her eye had clouded to milk. The Imbruns could do nothing more for her. The Americans took Ellery, and Miss Peregrine peeled off from them and came over to where we were huddled against a tree.
"Miss," Emma cried, and hugged her. "Where'd you come from?"
"I told you I'd be watching," she said, hair whipping in the helicopter's wind.
"Good thing, too."
"Will she die?"
Enoch shouted.
"We gave her an emergency serum to slow the worst of her aging, but she may still succumb to it. Where is Hugh?"
"He went to get help," Emma said.
"Hasn't come back."
A look of worry flashed across the Imbrun's face. We ran to find Hugh and spotted him by the wrecked bus, which was crumpled and lying on its side surrounded by flares and police tape. The police who had been standing guard over the accident had left to investigate the helicopter, so for the moment, no one was there to stop us from running right up to the bus's exposed undercarriage. As we approached, I saw that the tires were blown, the axles broken. Hugh was standing beside one, pulling at what looked like a rope. Ropes had tangled around the axles, clogged up the wheel wells.
"Ellery said something about ropes," Emma said as we ran toward Hugh. "She said there was another girl, and she used ropes to stop the bus."
"You were right," I said to Miss Peregrine. "There was a second person. A girl." But when we got closer, we saw that what Hugh was holding wasn't a rope at all. It was a vine. Vines were wrapped around the axles, around the wheels.
"What on earth?"
Emma said, picking one up. It was green and thorned, and here and there it had delicate purple flowers. "Ellery also said something about flowers," I said, "that the girl gave her flowers." Enoch picked one off the vine.
"I recognize this. They used to grow all around our house on Cairnholm."
Hugh still hadn't said anything. He took the flower from Enoch and held it up in the garish, dancing light of a flare.
"Miss," he said, a haunted look stealing over his boyish features. "This is a dog rose."
Miss Peregrine turned to him, locked eyes, and nodded seriously.
"Yes, Hugh."
I said, "I don't understand," but the others all seemed to.
"It was Fiona's flower," Emma said quietly.
"She could grow them even without meaning to. Sometimes they'd sprout behind her as she walked." I felt the air thin, my head go light.
"Are you saying?"
Enoch looked at the vines.
"Only Fee could have done something like this."
"Oh my God,"
Hugh cried, tears streaming down his cheeks.
She's alive.
Emma wrapped him in a hug, and he leaned into her. He was overjoyed and devastated all at once.
They have her. They have her. Oh, my love. Oh, my God.
We'll get her back, Hugh, Miss Peregrine said. Don't doubt it for a second.
Chapter 8. We would all be taking off in the American's chopper. It was big enough to fit everyone, and it was the quickest way out of there. We waited while the chopper was readied to leave. We were worn to the bone, our bedraggled bodies parked among the emergency vehicles. Miss Wren kept the police at bay somehow, I suspected with some wild story she had concocted or a few well-timed memory wipes. Lamoth alone remained upright, pacing anxiously while Miss Cuckoo and Miss Peregrine ministered to Ellery, applying balm to her forehead and what were ostensibly medicinal drops to her remaining eye. The cavity once covered by Ellery's eye patch was now half obscured by long hair. A pale worm poked its head through the silvery strands. Shuddering, I looked away, but the scene change didn't do much for the queasy feeling in my gut. Hugh, I realized, was nearing hysteria. Emma and Enoch were trying to keep him calm, but he still seemed too stunned to be reasoned with. Worse, he was crying again. I stood up and started toward him, but Emma pulled him close, curving their bodies together as she whispered anxiously in his ear. I took another step forward, and she stopped me with a single look, narrowing her eyes at me over his shoulder. Let me handle this, she mouthed. So I gave them space. I found myself briefly alone, feeling useless but simultaneously relieved to be useless. My deferred exhaustion now sank into me, muddling my mind despite my best efforts to remain vigilant. I leaned against a nearby police car, my propped elbow slipping with every passing second, watching Miss Cuckoo stalk down the roadside. Her manner was perfunctory as she memory-wiped any traffic-jammed normals who seemed too interested in what we were doing. I almost laughed. I felt lightheaded. And then, suddenly, I heard a voice. Nice to see you again. The fine hairs on the back of my neck stood on end, and I stiffened. It was a teasing sing-song of a voice, gentle but venomous, and strangely familiar. I turned to look around, but there were no strangers here. I heard it again. So, are you excited? The words seemed to rise up from somewhere inside of me, almost a manufacture of my own mind. I was so tired I wondered whether I'd slipped into a waking dream. No, a nightmare. Small, revolting little noises, lips smacking, vowels stretching, filled my head. They were sounds of exaggerated satisfaction, like someone snuggling into warm, clean sheets after a long day. The voice whispered, that's better. I could get used to this again. Who's there? I said, whipping around. Jacob, are you all right? Emma was staring at me. I blinked at her, startled, forgetting for a moment where I was. Yeah, I said. Sorry, I'm fine. I think I just fell asleep. I frowned at the lie. Maybe I should take a walk, get some air, clear my head. Emma nodded distractedly. She and Enoch both too focused on their own task, calming Hugh, to question my strange behavior. So I walked. Not too far to be irresponsible, but just far enough to clear the voice from my head and to convince myself of my own lies, that this was nothing, that I'd heard nothing. I took long, determined steps toward nothing, wending my way through the maze of emergency vehicles. The night air pushed at my body, the once welcome breeze growing aggressive. A sudden gust of wind wrapped around my legs so abruptly that I stumbled sideways, catching myself against the back doors of an ambulance. I heard the voice again.
"There's a new world coming," it whispered, "and it's going to be so beautiful."
"Who are you?" I said, hissing into the darkness.
"Just an old friend."
"And what does that mean?" I said, my head whipping back and forth and my heart racing. The voice laughed. It was a dark sound, rough and throaty, and then familiar words.
"Every land on earth will sink and reek and wallow in stench and stink of rotted trunks of beast and man and vegetation crisped on land."
A lock rattled. The back doors of the ambulance swung open, nearly knocking me off my feet. By now, I was thoroughly freaked out, and yet, somehow, I found myself drawing nearer the darkened interior. I didn't know why. I didn't even know I was searching for something until I saw it, until it seemed obvious what I might find here. A body, unmoving beneath a sheet. My every instinct was screaming at me to run, to call for help, to catch a flight back to my boring, predictable life in Florida. I shut it out, told it to die. And then I steeled myself and clambered into the ambulance. My heart beating out of my chest, I lifted a corner of the sheet. I saw the face of a young man, dead, half his head caved in.
"Jesus, just an old friend," the voice said, and now it was coming from the body, from the dead young man's bloodied mouth. "But I'll be back soon."
I let the sheet fall, my body now shaking uncontrollably. A song began to play from the radio in the cab, and play loud. It was "With a Little Help from My Friends." Chills ricocheted down my spine. I felt wild, out of control. I ran out of the ambulance and into Enoch. He grabbed me, eyes wide.
"Where'd you go?"
he shouted over a noise I hadn't noticed before, the chopper's engine.
"Come on," he said. "We're leaving."
And he pulled me away toward the waiting helicopter. 2 minutes later, we were in the air, strapped into seats, headsets muffling the roar of the blades. Ellery was laid across the laps of Lamoth and his bodyguard in the front row, and the rest of us were squeezed into the back. Miss Wren and Miss Cuckoo had had to assume bird form so we'd all fit, and they were perched near the pilot, scanning the dawning skies ahead. The Imbrins had done all they could to stabilize Ellery, but getting her back into a loop was her only real chance of avoiding death. So we were headed for the nearest one, some backwater town called Locust Gap. I was still shaken by what had happened on the ground a moment ago. Was it a vision? A hallucination? It was Call's voice I'd heard. Call's voice quoting the most apocalyptic parts of the prophecy to me, which meant... what? Which meant I was losing my mind, probably. Either that, or Call was just finding new and creative ways to torment me. Hugh was having a meltdown. Despite Emma's and Enoch's best efforts, he was doing worse.
"They've got Fiona right now,"
he was saying through his headset mic for all to hear.
"And the longer we take, the harder it will be to get her back. We need to search every loop within 300 miles of here. And we've got to do it now."
Emma put a hand on his arm.
"Hugh, that just won't work." "Sure it will. We've got a helicopter."
Lamoth turned around and glared.
This is my helicopter, boy, and the only place it's going is the nearest loop, so we can save this girl's life.
His glare shifted to Miss Peregrine.
Get your ward under control.
Please, Hugh, you must calm down, Miss Peregrine said. We need to choose our next move very carefully. We're all upset about this. We're all worried about Miss Frauenfeld. But this critical moment is the worst time to flail about blindly with no plan.
Fiona's loop bound too, Hugh muttered. She'll age forward too.
Oh, God, Emma said, going a bit pale. I forgot. I had forgotten too. Because Fiona wasn't at the Library of Souls with us when it collapsed, she hadn't had her internal clock reset like the others, which meant she could age forward. It's likely they took Fiona prisoner after Miss Wren's loop collapse, months and months ago, Miss Peregrine said. She was seen leaping from the cliff's edge. We can only surmise that she survived the fall and was collected from the woods below. Hugh's eyes fell shut as he imagined it.
What have they been doing with her? And what do they want with her?
We don't yet know, said Miss Peregrine, but you can be sure they didn't keep her alive all this time just to let her age forward in the middle of, Miss Peregrine glanced out the window, Iowa.
Yeah, Hugh said miserably, I suppose.
After we make this one stop, Miss Peregrine said, we'll return to Devil's Acre, gather all our people and intelligence, and make a proper plan. And we will get her back. He nodded.
If you say so, miss.
We touched down in a field next to an old barn, trees and bushes whipping in the downwash. The Imbrins and the Americans were out of the helicopter before the rotors even began to slow. Miss Wren and Miss Cuckoo winged into the barn in bird form, and by the time the rest of us had caught up to them, they were in their human shape and somehow fully dressed again, not a hair out of place. We helped Lamoth and his bodyguard carry Ellery up a ladder to the barn loft where the loop entrance was, and after a quick changeover that left my stomach jittery, we carried her down again and out into a warm, foggy morning.
Hold it right there, someone said,
and then I saw a man pointing a gun at us. He was seated casually in a wooden chair, and he wore a top hat and an odd mustachioed mask.
Name and clan affiliation, he barked. Don't you know who I am?
Lamoth thundered back.
Don't much care so long as you're not a Yankee and you got $50 for entry.
Then he tipped his head, sat forward, and muttered,
Wait a dad burns second.
That's right, said Lamoth's bodyguard. This is Antoine Lamoth, and if you don't want to find yourself in front of a firing squad.
Instantly, the man tossed away his gun and threw himself on the ground.
Sorry, Mr. Lamoth, sir. I didn't recognize, didn't expect you.
Miss Wren stepped forward and pulled the man to his feet.
We need a bed for this poor girl, she said. Somewhere we can make her comfortable while we apply a few poultices.
Of course, the man said, laughing nervously. There's an establishment just this way, very accommodating, and no doubt they'll waive the cost for distinguished persons like yourselves.
We followed him as he led the way, bowing and scraping toward a cluster of clapboard buildings. The largest had an awning that read Restaurant, spelled R-E-S. T-O-U-R-A-N-T. There were three people loafing at the entrance, a waiter in a white jacket and two cooks in matching aprons. The masked man shouted at them to prepare a room, and they straightened and disappeared inside. The Imbrins left us outside.
We won't be long, Miss Peregrine said to us. We just have to make sure the girl is stable, and then we'll go.
Hugh was a bundle of nervous energy. He was struggling to keep his freakout contained, and it was making a vein on his temple throb. I couldn't blame him. The love of his life was in the hands of Call's most notorious lieutenants,
and God knew what was happening, or had happened already, to her. But there was nothing any of us could do about it right then, so I looked around the bleak little town for something that might distract him.
"Want to know why Carl wears a mask? Bet you do," trilled a little voice,
and then a young girl emerged from around the corner of the restaurant. She couldn't have been more than 6. Her clothes were simple, brown hair cut into a short bob.
"Why," Enoch said boredly, "ambrosia addict?"
"It's for anonymity," she said, tripping over the word, then trying it again several times without success. "Whoever's guarding the entrance always wears a mask, just in case they have to kill anyone, so people don't go revenging on them."
"You don't say,"
said Enoch, more interested now.
"I'm Elsie, and you're new. You all here with those demi-imbrins to change the loop clock's gears? They've been getting stuck lately, causing trouble."
She spoke in rapid sing-song, her face intense with curiosity.
"Those weren't demi-imbrins," Emma said. "They were real ones."
"Ha!" she said. "You folks are funny."
"We're not joking," I said.
"And the furry guy with them was the leader of the Northern Clan," Enoch said.
"Serious?"
Elsie said, her eyes going wide.
"What are y'all doing here?"
"Can't talk about it," said Enoch. "Top secret." "And we're not staying long," Hugh added pointedly, and then his eyebrow shot up. "Unless you didn't happen to see 4 men come through here with a girl earlier today, did you?"
"Nope. Nobody's come through in months."
Hugh's face fell.
"Except old Hangy there."
She pointed to a desiccated corpse hung from a gallows across the street.
"He was a highwayman, tried to rob us, so we shot him and hung him up there as a warning. We take a real dim view of thieving ever since Brother Ted's sparkstone got stole."
She eyed us hopefully.
"You're not here about that, are you?"
"About what?" Enoch said.
"Brother Ted's sparkstone. I was hoping maybe if such important folks were here, it's 'cause the man who stole it been caught, and you all's come to return it."
"I'm sorry," Emma said with a note of genuine regret. "We don't know anything about that."
"Oh,"
her unsinkable spirits deflated a little.
"You want to meet Brother Ted anyhow? I know it'd cheer him. He ain't been the same."
"We really shouldn't," Emma said. Elsie's head hung.
"Aw, I understand,"
she said, then glanced over at a little house not far away.
"Though he lives just over yonder."
"Why not?" I said, "if it's close." I met eyes with Emma and nodded at Hugh, and she got the message.
"Yeah, let's meet him," she said, hooking her arm around Hugh's. 23 skidoo,
the girl yipped. Hugh came reluctantly, and we all walked over to the little house while Elsie talked a mile a minute.
"It's been slow, slow, slow lately. Nobody around at all. Just some salesman and a loop keeper. Teacher's supposed to come and give me lessons soon. Other than that, it's awful boring here. Where'd you come from?"
"London," Emma said.
"Oh, I always wanted to go somewhere big like that. Is it nice?"
Enoch laughed.
"Not particularly."
"That's okay. I still want to see it. What time are you from? I mean, when were you born?"
"You ask a lot of questions," Hugh said.
"Yeah, that's what I'm famous for. Brother Ted calls me the interrogatrix. Will you take me with you when you go home?"
Emma looked surprised.
"You don't like it here?"
"I just want to see someplace besides Locust Gap. I was born in Cincinnati, by the way, but I've been here since I was 4.
"That's not so long," I said. She nodded.
"Yeah, I reckon not. I'm only 44.
We entered the little house. It was like stepping into an oven. There was a huge fireplace roaring with flames, a pile of heavy blankets in front of it.
"Hi, brother,"
said Elsie, and the blanket pile turned slightly in our direction. There was a kid in there, cocooned in the middle of all that.
"Good Lord," said Hugh. "He'll be roasted alive."
"Don't touch him,"
Elsie warned.
You'll get frostbite. He's got a temperature of minus 50. Hello there, the boy said, shivering the words out. His skin was blue, his eyes red-rimmed.
Poor thing,
Emma whispered. Sweat was already beading on my forehead, but as I approached the boy, I could feel waves of cold emanating from him, beating back the heat and the sweat. I turned to Elsie. You said someone stole his... what now?
His spark stone,
she said, and gave the boy a mournful smile.
He'd tell you himself, but it's hard for him to talk. His tongue gets so stiff with cold.
Maybe I can help, said Emma, if just for a little while. And she summoned flames in both her hands, stoked them until they were bright, and stood with them held above the boy.
That's nice, he chattered. Thank you, ma'am.
The temperature was getting unbearable. The hotter it became, the more I began to notice a strange, acrid smell, like someone cooking trash. But I tried to forget about it and focus. The boy was warming just enough to form sentences now.
I have this condition, Ted said, his skin a shade or two less blue. Only thing that ever helped me live normal was the spark stone, a little green stone that was always aflame and never went out, which my Imbrin gave to me long ago.
He looked sad and wistful.
This was back when we had Imbrins. She'd brought it from far away. She said, cross the sea. She said if I kept it in my stomach, it would keep me warm always. And it did for a long, long time.
The smell was starting to become even more oppressive than the heat. I pinched my nose closed against it. Strangely, it didn't seem to be bothering anyone else.
And then that man came to town,
the boy went on, his words flowing easily now.
He said he was a doctor. I was always a little cold, never could go without a coat and a sweater, and he said he could fix that for me, if I just coughed up the spark stone and let him tinker with it.
I was listening so intently that I didn't realize I had been walking toward the corner of the room until I was halfway there. Something was drawing me. The smell. And a queasy feeling.
He took it from me, said the boy, and when I tried to chase him and get it back, something stopped me, something strong that I couldn't see.
He was shaking his head, blinking back tears.
It pinned me to the wall, stuffed my mouth so I couldn't scream. I passed out.
There, in the corner, was a spot on the floor that had been stained black. The source of the smell.
Jacob, Emma said quickly, that sounds like...
A hollow gasped, I said. And there's a drop of its residue right here. The boy nodded.
That's where it held me.
When was this? I asked.
5-6 months ago, said Elsie.
What did the man look like?
Like anybody, he said, blinking. Like nobody.
He had glasses, didn't he, Ted?
Elsie said.
Dark glasses that he never took off.
There was a loud knock on the door, and it opened. Miss Peregrine came into the room and then drew in a sharp breath, overwhelmed by the heat.
We're going,
she said. Hugh and Enoch said quick goodbyes and ran after Miss Peregrine. Elsie looked at me, pleading.
Ain't there something you can do? You know fancy people.
We have a lot on our plate right now, I said, but we won't forget you. Elsie nodded, bit her lip.
Thank you, Ted said. It's always nice to see friendly faces. Don't get much of that around here.
I'm so sorry, Emma said to him. I wish we could stay longer.
It's okay, he said, sighing,
and he turned his gaze heavily back toward the fireplace. Elsie did too. And for a moment, in the strong light of the fire, she looked both young and ancient and lost. Emma slowly closed her hands. She seemed so sad and sorry. We barely knew these people, but her heart was, as I already knew, bigger than France. By the time we got to the door, the boy had already started to turn blue again.
Chapter 9. We left Ellery in Locust Gap with Lamoth's bodyguard. I wanted to see how she was doing, but the Imbrins insisted that she needed rest and quiet, not visitors. Our fast action had saved her life, but what kind it would be remained to be seen. She had aged most of a normal lifetime in a single evening, and the effect that had on one's brain was often dramatic. Still, Lamoth seemed grateful for what we'd done. He didn't say as much, but I could tell. He was quiet on the helicopter ride back to Marrowbone, less quick to snap and grumble, and his raccoons had finally stopped whining and writhing. The rest of us didn't talk much. Enoch fell asleep. Emma talked quietly with Hugh for most of the ride, massaging his bald fists back into open hands. I thought about Noor. I'd been doing that a lot lately, pretty much whenever I wasn't being distracted by someone less interesting or something life-threatening. In quiet moments, I only had to picture her face, and I'd feel 10-20% less stressed. The tension that cleaved my chest nearly all the time would slacken, and sometimes, if I pictured being close to her, if I imagined kissing her, that tension would shift into something else. A clench of pure wanting, of desire. If I was being honest, it was something I'd never felt about Emma. What we'd had was so chaste, so Victorian. What I felt for Noor was different, more chemical, more visceral, but tender, too. She was so brand new to this world. I wondered how she was feeling, whether she was adjusting. Was she okay? Were they making any progress with Millard's maps, coming any closer to finding V's loop? What would that be like if, no, when, Noor found her? Which reminded me, what about finding Fiona? Since Ellery and Lamoth's bodyguards weren't along for this ride, Miss Wren and Miss Cuckoo had the space to stay in human form, and they talked low and serious with Miss Peregrine for most of the trip. I hoped they were hatching ideas about where the Whites had taken Fiona, for Fiona's sake and for Hugh's, but I couldn't be sure. Before all this had happened, Hugh had actually begun to have moments of peace and fun and levity, but now the wound had been ripped open again, and it was twice as wide. I knew him well enough to know he wouldn't rest until she was back among us and safe again. And that if, bird forbid, something happened to her, it would absolutely kill him. I shoved that thought away, and in its place a question popped into my head that I had been dying to ask Miss Peregrine. I couldn't do it over the headset mic, though. It wasn't something I wanted Lamoth to hear. He seemed to be asleep, his bald head smooshed against the window, but still, I couldn't wait. Either.
I have to know something.
I leaned over her seat, whispering, and she turned away from the other Imbrins.
Back in Marrowbone, in the camp, when you found the start of the Hologast's trail, it wasn't just the boot print, was it?
Miss Peregrine shook her head.
No.
Hugh was listening intently now.
I found this outside the tent, amongst the trees.
And she drew from her blouse a pressed purple flower, a dog rose. Hugh reached out and touched it, turned it over in his hand.